Audio Journal is supported in part by the Memorial Foundation for the Blind and the Massachusetts Commission for the Blind. We are a proud member of the Massachusetts Audio Information Network.
Worcester Regional Transit Authority, also known as the WRTA, is a regional transit system that services the city of Worcester and the surrounding 36 communities in the central Massachusetts area, with a bus fleet that includes all-electric buses, as well as many diesel-electric hybrid buses. The second largest regional transit authority in Massachusetts, the WRTA offers reliable, comfortable, and safe transportation for traveling to work, shopping, school, medical appointments, and leisure activities. The WRTA also provides paratransit service for the elderly and disabled, as well as a variety of special services for those groups in the entire service area. For more information, visit the website at www.therta.com or call 508-791-9782.
What's going on in your town is important to you. Meetings that decide your taxes, changes in laws in your community, plans for new housing and businesses, and news about schools are all vital for you to know. Here on Audio Journal, we read many local community newspapers each week. In addition to the news of your community and area, you'll also hear about special events, stories about your neighbors, their businesses, their activities, and more. Stay in touch with your community on Audio Journal, broadcasting to print-impaired residents of Central Massachusetts.
You can sense it when you visit the island of Iona in the Inner Hebrides.
There's a saying which says, "The earth is thin here, where tissue paper separates the spiritual from the material world." And you feel it, you get it, as you step off the boat.
Coming up, hear what you can find on the islands that pepper the west coast of Scotland. You can get close to Ireland's dramatic history in its literature and songs.
People like William Butler Yeats and other great artistic Irish people brought these legends back to life in poetry and in songs.
Irish Guides introduce us to the places and characters of ancient Ireland. And Laurie Erickson describes what her family research travels to Norway revealed.
When enough time passes, what was once scandalous simply becomes amusing and interesting.
Explore ancient Ireland, the Scottish Hebrides, and even the roots to your family tree in the hour ahead. It's Travel with Rick Steves. Have you started researching your family history after seeing your DNA results? Coming up, a clergywoman from Iowa tells us how it helped her appreciate the struggles and stories of her Viking ancestors. We'll also hear how the sights and tales of ancient Ireland resonate with the Irish today. But our first stop on this hour's Travel with Rick Steves is along the timeless west coast of Scotland. In some ways, the traditions of Scotland survive most vividly in its islands off the west coast. These are the Hebrides. We've invited two of our favorite Scottish guides into the studio to share stories and tips on their favorite islands. Liz Lister is from Fife, Cullen Mares is from Glasgow, and they're both here with us now to share a little better understanding of Scotland's Inner Hebrides. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Hey, Cullen, when you think about the Hebrides, we hear that word a lot, Hebrides. These are the islands off of the west of Scotland, but there's Inner and Outer Hebrides.
Yeah.
What's the story there?
So the Inner Hebrides, they're basically the ones that are closer to mainland Scotland, the Outer Hebrides further out. So probably most people going to visit islands off the coast of Scotland will go to the Inner Hebrides, they're easier to access.
Liz, when you're thinking of the Inner Hebrides, which ones are your favourites and which one's the most popular with the tourists?
Well, Oban, which is on the west coast of Scotland, is known as the Charing Cross of the islands. There's a saying, the earth unto the Lord belongs and all that it contains, except the Kyles and the Western Isles, for these are all McBrains. And McBrains, Caledonian McBrains, are the ferry company. So people will come to Oban, and that's the jumping off point to go to the islands.
So Oban is the Charing Cross. Charing Cross would be the big train station in London.
That's
from
right.
Where you depart to go to different places. So Oban would be the jumping off point. It's the big port on the mainland from where the ferries go.
Absolutely.
To the different islands. So Kyles, what is Kyles?
Kyles are the stretches of water. So the little islands are skerries.
So the straits and the bays.
Isles and the
and
Kyles.
The so everything is the Lord's except for the isles and the waters.
Kyles.
And that
because
is
the McBrains have the, they are the major link backwards and forwards to the islands. They carry passengers, they carry freight, they carry tourists. So
this is the ferry system. Mm-hmm. Caledonian McBray, is that
That's
what it
correct.
Is?
Correct, yes.
Yeah, because every time I think of an island scene, there's a dramatic ferry coming across it. It's just a beautiful thing.
And you have the jumping off point in the railway terminal at Oban. And so people coming from Glasgow will directly connect with the ferries and go out. So in answer to your question, probably the most two popular are the ones closest. So Mull and Iona we can come back to because Iona is really accessible as a day or, you know, for a particular reason.
Okay, so you got Mull and you got Iona because those are the first stops on the ferries are very close by. Cullen, when you think of the Inner Hebrides, what are some of the names that come to mind of the islands, the major islands?
So you've got Mull and Iona and you've got Skye, that's probably the most well-known one.
Mm-hmm.
There's islands with quite humorous names like Muck, Egg and Rum.
Muck, Egg and Rum.
Yes.
Have you been to any of those islands?
I've not actually, no. But you see them as you drive towards the, when you're going by ferry to the Isle of Skye.
Now, the island that is so famous now and so trendy really is Skye.
Mm-hmm.
And when you think about Skye, what should a traveller know if they want to visit Skye?
Skye is really popular because it's got a bridge. So some of the people from the other islands of the Hebrides, they'll claim that Skye is no longer an island. It's just part of the mainland now. It's linked. But it's very hot just now, very, very popular, and you've got some of the most amazing scenery in all of Scotland, especially
quite
in the north
you
of the Isle of Skye.
You can drive up to viewpoints and take beautiful hikes, go to the far north and see ruined castles, drive by peat bogs.
Yes.
When you see a peat bog, what do you think?
Well, I think about whiskey. but peat bogs, that's where people for centuries have taken the peat from the ground, and peat is like coal but a few thousand years younger. And they'll put the peat on the fire to warm the home, and it's also used in the whiskey industry for drying out the barley. It gives Scotch whiskies the peaty, smoky flavours.
So if you want to visit a whiskey distillery, they're all over Scotland.
Yeah, you've got two on the Isle of Skye, and one just right next to Skye on the Isle of Rassy, 25-minute ferry ride.
Would they be particularly peaty because this is peat?
Well, Talisker is the longest established distillery in Skye, for a long time the only distillery there, and it's a medium peaty whiskey.
And I'd like to welcome you aboard the Isle of Mull for a sailing to Oban.
This is Travel with Rick Steves. We're talking with tour guides Cullen Mayers and Elizabeth Lister, and we're talking about the Inner Hebrides Islands in Scotland. And Cindy in Kerry, North Carolina, emailed us, and Cindy writes, "We visited the Isle of Skye by renting a car from Inverness and driving there. The driving was quite an experience with not only driving on the left-hand side, but also single-track roads and livestock encounters. It's a place that is really difficult to be on time schedule-wise. You have to allow a lot of time for getting around, even if the distance don't look very far on a map." So that's interesting when you're driving. It is handy to have a car for the Isle of Skye, and you can rent one at Inverness. I think the roads are pretty good from Inverness to Skye.
Yeah.
And then you get on Skye, and what's driving on Skye like?
So driving in Skye in some parts, especially when you go north of Portree and around that loop called the Trotternish, you've got a lot of parts that are single-track road, and they'll just have passing places.
Right.
So you've got to kind of understand how they work. It's basically, we drive on the left, and so you pull in only to the left. So basically, whoever's closest to, if you're coming head-to-head on a Skye standoff, it's the person who's got the closest space to them on their left. They should pull into that one.
Into that. So there are these little pull-ups, very strategically positioned.
And also, because of the pressure of tourism, a lot of the smaller islands, not just Skye, but the smaller islands with the single-track roads, they say that they don't drive on the left in Mull, they drive on what's left.
Oh, now that's a good way to put it. Liz, when you drive around the islands, you're likely to see traditional lifestyles, and you hear people referring to a crofter. What's a crofter?
People think that a croft is the house that's built on the land. A croft is actually a package of land on which the crofter had to build their own house. Now, they were in a terrible situation that if they improved their house, they didn't own the land, they were simply tenants. And so for a long time, if they improved their home, the factor, the manager of the land, could take the home away from them. And so they were basically enslaved. And that led to the crofting acts of the 1800s, where people began to get ownership of their land so that it could pass it on from generation to generation. So now there's so much red tape that they say that a croft is a package of land wrapped up in red tape.
Oh, my goodness. So when we think about the Highland clearances and the crofters and so on, there must be museums that let you learn about that as a traveller. What's one that you would recommend?
So on the Isle of Skye, in the very far north of the Isle, there's a place called the Museum of Island Life. Mm-hmm. And it's basically a collection of preserved, some of them were real houses that people lived in, croft houses. Other ones have been built just to house more parts of the museum. And so it just shows the traditional way that people lived on the Isle of Skye, the traditional architecture and way of life.
It's a delightful, intimate little chance to go into a home, a stone home with a sod roof, and imagine what it was like on that windy, desolate corner of the British Isles.
Yeah, so they're thatched roofs, and they're built to fit in with the landscape. They're aerodynamic, really, taking that fierce winds off the sea.
They survive the wind.
Mm-hmm.
What are a couple of more things you might see or do while you go to Skye?
So one of the other main attractions in Skye is Dunvegan Castle. Uh-huh. So that's over towards the west, near to the town of Dunvegan. And that's the home of the MacLeods. It's one of the big clans, and they claim to be the longest inhabited, continuously inhabited castle in Scotland, inhabited for over 800 years now.
So you took me to a place that has not been continuously inhabited, but is actually quite old. Describe that. And how old is it?
So it's known as Dunbeg Broch. It is several thousands of years old.
So going back like Stonehenge time.
Yes, it's Stonehenge time, sort of 3,000 years old or so.
But you stand on that hilltop and you see all these stones scattered all around and you think those were all stacked up together and made a fort?
Yeah, and so if you see it or see a picture of it, it was once upon a time five times that height. Uh-huh. Basically a defensive structure where the people could get inside and get safe with their animals, and it was a lookout point as well, see anyone coming attacking from the sea.
Our guides to Scotland's Inner Hebrides are Cullen Mares, who offers custom tours of New Zealand and Australia when he's not leading them in Scotland during the summer, and Liz Lister, who arranges tours of Scotland from her home base in Fife and co-hosts the Scottish Blethers podcast. We have links to their websites and more about Scottish history at ricksteves.com/radio. Liz Lister, one of the most famous destinations in the Inner Hebrides is the enchanting Isle of Iona. What's special about Iona?
It is absolutely enchanting. People go there for the peace and tranquility of this beautiful island. As you leave Finnefort, which is the port on Mull, it's a 10-minute ferry journey back in time. There's a community, a religious community on Iona, which was started by a man called George MacLeod. In the 1930s, he lived on the Clyde in Glasgow, and he was a minister. And he wanted to be able to give the opportunity to preach and become ministers to young people in the community. But he also saw the terrible unemployment, and he wanted to give craftsmen work and apprenticeships. So he brought the two together to restore the abbey on the island of Iona. And still today, on the walls of Iona Abbey, there's a saying which says, "The earth is thin here, where tissue paper separates the spiritual from the material world." And you feel it, you get it as you step off the boat. Yes. This is a spiritual place that has drawn people right back to the time of St. Columba.
St. Columba. And he brought Christianity to Scotland. What century would that have been?
St. Columba was the 600s, the 7th century.
The 600s.
And he was born the son of a royal family in Donegal in Ireland. He was raised to become a priest. It was said that he burned like a fierce light, that he could bring the word of Christianity to people. But the roots aren't clear. It seems that he got himself into trouble. Some say that he went into battle. Some say that he copied the first act of plagiarism. But for whatever reason, he was exiled. And he was told that he had to sail until he could no longer see his beloved Ireland. So he sailed to Colonsay, climbed a hill. He could still see Ireland. He sailed on. He landed on Iona, climbed a hill, and he could no longer see Ireland. He travelled with a group of 12 followers who were friends and family. One of them was a man called Orin, his uncle. And Uncle Orin said that he would make a human sacrifice of himself and that he should be buried alive. So they buried Uncle Orin. threw earth over his head and left him for 3 days. And after 3 days, they dug him up again. Orin sat up and he said that there was no great wonder in heaven and hell wasn't all that it was described as. And so this was totally against the teachings of Christianity. So they shouted, "Earth, earth o'er Orin's eyes, lest he blab some more." And this time when they buried him, they didn't dig him up again.
I haven't heard that story. Next time I go to Iona, I'll ask a local person about that.
He has a chapel. He's got that consolation. He has St. Orin's chapel.
Mm-hmm. Well, even if you're, regardless of your religion or if you're not even a religious person, when you do go to Iona, there is something special about the atmosphere there, and it's well worth the trip.
Absolutely.
This is Travel with Rick Steves. We've been talking about the Inner Hebrides of Scotland, and we've been joined by our tour guides, Cullen Mares and Liz Lister. Thanks, both of you, for helping us better understand this beautiful part of Scotland.
Thank you.
On behalf of Caledonian McBrain, we'd like to thank you for travelling with us today, and we hope you have a pleasant crossing. Thank you.
We'll look at Ireland's ancient stories in just a bit. But first, Laurie Erickson tells us how researching her family history in Norway revealed how the spirit of her Viking ancestors influenced who she is today. It's Travel with Rick Steves. She grew up in a passionately Norwegian-American farm town in Iowa, but author Laurie Erickson didn't really feel much appreciation for its old country heritage until a DNA test sparked an interest in her family history and in her deep Scandinavian roots. Laurie wanted to dig even deeper into her family tree, so, like many of her Viking ancestors, she embarked on a far-ranging quest, minus the pillaging, and she discovered how her soul has been shaped by her ancestors, and she finds unexpected spiritual guides among the seafaring Vikings and her hardscrabble immigrant ancestors. As an Episcopalian deacon, Laurie writes about the intersection of travel and spirituality. In her latest book, The Soul of the Family Tree, she explores how genealogy can be a catalyst for unique travel experiences that can nurture your soul and your identity. Laurie joins us now from the Iowa Public Radio studios in Iowa City. Welcome, Laurie.
Well, it's great to be back, Rick.
Hey, I was so interested to hear that you grew up in a passionately Norwegian-American Iowa town, and you kind of rolled your eyes at all that Nordic festival stuff, the steaming pots of rummagrot and the old world traditions, and then you changed your feelings about that. Tell me how you all of a sudden thought, oh, this is not just kitschy, this is real.
Well, I think my experience is actually mirrored by a lot of people, that you take for granted what you grow up with, and it's only with the perspective of years and distance and maybe moving away that you have a better sense for the treasures and the depth of what you were given when you were growing up. For me, I think an interest in genealogy was sparked as well by losing more and more elderly relatives, the sense that your living relatives are dwindling and your relatives on the other side are growing in number. And I started, first of all, to get interested in the genetic part of it. And so, as you said, having a DNA test was important. Yeah. But then the cultural part really became more interesting to me as well.
And just, I'm Norwegian also, and I remember my earliest memories in Norway was visiting relatives who proudly took me out to a very, very traditional place for that steaming bowl of rummagrot. So we have these icons of our heritage that we don't appreciate when we're younger. But, you know, that's interesting when you say you got more relatives on the other side as the years go by. And you mention it is the quintessential hobby of middle age. So we get into middle age and all of a sudden, oh, yeah, I wish I talked more to great grandma before she left us. You know, I had a powerful experience when my mother passed away. I was at her deathbed. And when she died, it was the most interesting, powerful sort of
primal feeling that she was like on a Viking ship, like a queen face up and just sailing away as she, as her soul left. And you write that you might find that your soul has been shaped by your ancestors and that they continue to influence you. I mean, if somebody hasn't had that experience, they might not take it seriously, but it really was a powerful thing.
Well, one of the concepts that I play around with in my book is something called the Web of Weird. Weird spelled W-Y-R-D, and it's from an old Norse word, an old Viking word. It's a word that we get our term weird from, but they had a much larger meaning for weird. It had to do with fate or destiny or maybe even a touch of karma. And so the Web of Weird is this network of connection between the past and the present and the future. And, you know, it has a lot of similarities to a family tree when you think about it. Only the Web of Weird is, I think, much bigger and much more mystical and has all sorts of spiritual implications that may not be so obvious in a simple family tree.
Because a family tree is very, like, two-dimensional, and it's just, you know, there's this, then there's that, then there's this. But are you saying it's like there's more depth to it and there's...
Uh-huh. The idea in pre-Christian Scandinavia was that when you were born, your fate was decided by the three Norns, who are similar to the three fates of Greek mythology, and that they would plan out sort of the outlines of your future, but that you were also given, it was called Urlaug, and you were given what your ancestors had formed, and that was part of who you would become in your lifetime. And so very much a sense of connection to the past. They also had a deep belief in the power of ancestors to be reborn in family lines. The idea that there might be spirits that are associated with a family that would pass from one person to the next, that they could be lent to someone if that person was going off to battle or, you know, and was in need of extra help for one reason or another. Mm-hmm. I mean, there's just a whole set of rich folklore connected to ancestors that I found fascinating.
You know, you mentioned that Urlaug, and it seems parallel to the concept of terroir when you're talking about what makes wine special. And it's more than just the grapes. And it's this, and it seems a little woo-woo sometime, but you get there and you enjoy the wine and you understand the magic of the love and the generations and the culture and the heritage that's all worked into that. And you really go, yeah, that's something much more, it's not just a simple recipe. There's a lot to it. And maybe that's what shapes our connection with our past and makes that family tree a little more complex.
Mm-hmm. Well, and also in my book, I try to expand the concept of genealogy beyond genetics to this idea of cultural transmission and also to the spiritual ancestors that we have. And I think that's a concept that most people can relate to who have spiritual inclinations, that you have, in a sense, spiritual forefathers and foremothers. You know, it might be St. Francis, or it might be the Dalai Lama or Vivekananda in the Hindu tradition. People who have influenced you and who have helped shaped your soul and who are, in a sense, your relatives, your kin.
Lori Erickson is a deacon with the Episcopalian Church in Iowa City. She's known for writing about spiritual journeys of many varieties. She's written The Soul of the Family Tree to describe how tracing her genealogy enhanced her spiritual life as she recognized her ancestors' role in shaping who she is today. Her website is LoriErickson.net. Lori's also written about end-of-life customs that she's observed in different cultures in Near the Exit. We'll replay her interview on that in late October on Travel with Rick Steves. So, Lori, this is a travel show, and you write about genealogy, and the intersection of genealogy and travel is fascinating to me. How can genealogy be a catalyst for unique travel experiences that you're having in order to nurture your soul and your identity? I mean, your whole book is filled with being on the road.
Well, I do think that family roots travel is a huge part of the travel market that people aren't as aware of because it goes on sort of underneath the radar because people are traveling not to major tourist attractions generally. They might be traveling to a farm in Alabama or to a village in Sicily or, you know, a battlefield in France. And so they're places of individual meaning. But I think anyone who has done any genealogical research at all other than at their computer, realizes the joy of being in a place that is connected to your larger story, mm-hmm. that there's a kind of visceral jolt that can happen there that is, it's hard to describe, but once you feel it, you know exactly what it is, and you want to feel it more in other places.
Yes. And, you know, a lot of people are wondering, post-COVID, how are we going to be traveling? An interesting thing about genealogy travel is it's meaningful travel rather than just bucket list sort of travel. And it gets you away from the crowds, which people are wondering, how can I travel and just kind of be more peaceful? Genealogy travel is by nature not touristy.
And I think another aspect of that is that during the pandemic, when people were home so much, I think a lot of people were doing more genealogical research. It was something that you could do from the safety of your home. And so I actually think there's going to be a real boom in family roots travel once people really start getting out and about. As you said, graveyards and small towns and places that aren't packed with people but still have a lot of potential meaning.
Okay, so now you went to Norway, and I bet you're expert at genealogical travel or genealogy travel. Where did you go in Norway, and what were you hoping to find?
Well, in the course of my book, I just chose one set of great-great-grandparents because no one is going to be that interested in all of my many Norwegian relatives. And so I chose them at random because I like the sound of their names from my family tree. They sounded very Norwegian. They had lots of those Norwegian vowels in them. But it actually was a very serendipitous choice because they turned out to have interesting stories, and they were from one of the most beautiful parts of Norway, and they were both baptized in the Borgen Church, which is probably the most beautiful medieval church in Norway. It's one of the
iconic stave church, I think, isn't it?
Right, with dragon heads on the side and on the edges of the roofs, and it's quintessential Norway. Mm-hmm. And so I went to their place, and I went to a farm that my great-great-grandfather Hans had been a sharecropper, essentially. He had never owned land. They had never owned land. They were very poor in Norway. And I got the chance to stand there, and I took a little bit of the soil. My husband laughs that I took probably half the soil from that little plot because it was so rocky. And I took the soil and I brought it back and I put it on their grave, their joint grave in Northeast Iowa, sort of connecting stories. And that was really meaningful to do that. Yeah. And I brought my sons along. I brought my sister as well. So it was a real family pilgrimage.
And then to follow up on your Viking heritage, you did some traveling in the New World. You went to the coast of Newfoundland, a Viking settlement.
Yes.
Yeah. Well, tell us about that.
Well, my name is Lori Erickson, and for my entire life, I have always said that I am a descendant of the explorer, the Norse explorer Leif Erickson, who was the first European to live in North America, in Canada, in a colony that it was called Vinland, but it was later discovered that in Newfoundland as Lanza Meadows is the name of it. And so I went to stand in the footsteps of Leif Erickson, even though I have to admit that the 1,000 years between us probably means that it's going to be awfully hard for me to trace my direct descent from Leif Erickson. But I have been fascinated by the Vikings, and to be able to go to that windswept, remote spot on the very, very edge of the continent and see some of the artifacts that were left behind, to see the recreations of the 11th century Norse buildings was tremendously meaningful, even though it was family in that larger sense.
We're exploring how genealogy can be a tool for travel and self-discovery right now on Travel with Rick Steves. Lori Erickson is our guest. Her latest book, The Soul of the Family Tree, seeks to show us what's so interesting about our forgotten relatives, basically. Lori's also explored end-of-life traditions around the world in her earlier book. It's called Near the Exit. And global spiritual connections is her topic of her book called Holy Rover. Lori, it's so nice to have you. And, you know, DNA testing has been hugely popular lately. You wrote it's kind of the lazy person's entry into genealogy. What do you think about DNA testing as a way to help empower your quest?
I think people have two opinions of it. I have a number of friends who have said that they would never have it done. They're concerned about privacy issues. And I think that's a legitimate concern. But I also think that it can be a tremendous tool for self-discovery and also connections with other family members. You know, once you have that done, you can choose whether you want to be connected to other family trees. Mm-hmm. And I also think that it's a good thing. It reminds people of how we're interconnected and how you may think you're English, but you're actually Polish, or that the mixing in your ancestral pot was much more of a stew than you realized. And I think there are interesting surprises waiting for people if they choose to do their DNA.
You know, that was a kind of a jolt for me. I just assumed I was all Norwegian, and I got my DNA, and I realized, oh, no, I got a little bit of Spanish in me. Well, that's cool. But I didn't. You never would have thought that. It's kind of a little reality test of, as you said, what we share is so much greater than what separates us, and we are that wonderful mix. I would imagine it is a little risky. In fact, I just met a man, believe it or not, a couple of weeks ago, and he got his DNA testing, and he discovered he had a child, and he actually met a son of his that he didn't even know he had. And I thought, whoa, you could get yourself in big trouble by going for a DNA test. Of course, that's an immediate thing, but as we dig deeper into our family trees and put that all together, we do stumble onto some dark parts of our past. Your husband would even joke with you, as you wrote about in the book, that every time you go to another community, you go, oh, there's another place our relatives attacked because of the pillaging and plundering of the Vikings.
That's right.
But I think there's a little bit of a statute of limitations on bad relatives when they're eight generations ago. Why would anybody be upset about
that? Well, that's one of the things I write about in my book, is how genealogy, through a lot of history, has been about trying to claim connections to important people. But I think one of the things that's happened to genealogy within the last couple of decades is this interest in finding colorful characters. So there are genealogical societies, for example, for descendants of the illegitimate sons and daughters of the English kings and queens, for example, or descendants of people who were tried and convicted of witchcraft in New England in the 17th century. My husband brags about the fact he had a relative who was hanged for being a horse thief in Wyoming. When enough time passes, what was once scandalous simply becomes amusing and interesting.
Yeah, I have a friend of mine who's kind of digging into my family tree. It's her hobby, and she was worried that I'd be upset because she found somebody who was not a very nice guy several generations ago. And I thought, no, I think it's kind of fascinating. You write also about spiritual DNA, the idea of when you dig deep in a certain way, you can find spiritual DNA. What does that mean?
Well, it relates to what I was saying about recognizing your spiritual kin and the influences that have shaped you. But I think, too, I was very taken by this Norse idea that your ancestors can influence you and that they are wanting to connect with you. And that's a very cross-cultural concept. A lot of different cultures around the world have had that belief. And so I think that, you know, part of it is realizing you're not so alone, that even if maybe you don't have a large immediate family, you still have these people, in a sense, standing behind you. And these were people who really almost certainly went through very, very hard times. And in learning about their stories, I think it can give you additional strength to get through your own trials. So I think genealogy in general is an argument against extreme individualism, the sense that we create ourselves and everything is just due to us. Instead, we really are the product of a lot of different forces.
In fact, you write, as we ponder our family tree, some humility is required. This is Travel with Rick Steves. We've been talking with Lori Erickson, and her book is The Soul of the Family Tree. And Lori, I'd just like to close with just your comment on a thought. You wrote about being perched on the branch of a family tree, gazing upwards, peering downwards, marveling at the tragedies and the triumphs that we see all around us. Take us up into that tree just for a moment and share kind of the value of actually climbing that tree and looking up and down.
I think since doing the research and writing my book, I really do have a different sense for myself. And I think it has to do with this sense of not just being an individual. And I think it has to do with this web of weird idea, the sense of all the threads of connection that unite me to my ancestors, to my distant, distant ancestors, the Vikings, to people who have an interest in contemporary Norwegian culture, to people who have an interest in genealogy. I mean, there are connections that unite us in all sorts of ways. And I think it's good to be reminded of that in a time when there's just, you know, there's a lot of division and a lot of conflict. And really, we are all part of the same family. We are all part of the human family tree.
You know, that is so fundamental to the value of travel. And it's been so fun talking to you about genealogy as a kind of travel, really. And I guess I can say when it comes to genealogy, we can also wish people happy travels. Lori, thanks so much.
Oh, thank you for having me, Rick.
Lori Erickson tells us about learning to read Scandinavian runestones in an extra to today's interview. It's posted at ricksteves.com/radio. The equinox was important to ancient Celts as they observed the cycles of the sun. Friends from Ireland share legends and traditions that put them in touch with their ancestors. That's next on Travel with Rick Steves. We're at 877-333-RICK. The Irish argue that their island's mythology is as interesting as that of ancient Greece or Rome. The oral traditions of the ancient Celts and the scribes of the Middle Ages provide a fertile landscape for understanding Ireland from the perspective of its Celtic roots. We've invited a couple of Irish guides, Stephen McPhillamy and Joe Darcy, into our studio to share their favorite legends and myths of Ireland and the places you can visit on the island they call home. Joe and Stephen, thanks for joining us.
Thanks, Rick.
Thank you.
It is a big part of going to Ireland, this vivid folk culture, mythology, and so on. Stephen, Ireland is rich in legends. Tell us an example of one that you like.
My favorite is Cú Chulainn. He was the greatest Celtic warrior of them all. Any visitor who goes to Dublin will go to O'Connell Street, and they have the General Post Office there where the 1916 rebellion happened. There's a beautiful bronze statue of this glorious Celtic warrior, the epitome of Celtic Irish manhood, but he's dying and there's a black raven on his shoulder and he's got a sword in one hand, and the raven is there because his father was the Celtic god of the sky who was coming to earth in the form of a raven. And when he was young, he was called Satanta, and he killed the most ferocious Irish wolfhound. One day he played hurling, the ancient Irish game that the Celts played, and the wolfhound attacked him, and he killed this wolfhound by hitting a round little ball like a baseball and stuck it in his throat. The hound's owner was called Cullen, and Cullen came out and said, "You've killed my dog, my guardian, my ferocious hound. Who's going to guard me now?" And young chivalrous Satanta said, "I shall guard you for the rest of your life, and I shall be called Cú Chulainn," which means the Hound of Cullen.
Whoa. See, now, I've walked by that many times, and I've never really appreciated it. It sort of enlivens your experience when you know the stories. Did you learn that in school? Did your parents teach it to you? Did you read a book? How would you know these kind of legends?
Yes, I learned it in school. But in the 1800s, we had this Celtic revival. Yeah. And people like William Butler Yeats and other great artistic Irish people brought these legends back to life in poetry and in song. So we learn about them in school, but we also hear about them in poems and songs all the time.
So you sing about it. So it comes up in your music.
All the time, yeah. And
right.
Also in our art.
Joe, that was fun to hear Stephen's myth.
Can I add just a bit?
The whole Cú Chulainn saga is called the Ulster Cycle.
Mm-hmm.
And one of my favourite parts of the Ulster Cycle is the men of Ulster were gathered at their big games. And the King of Ulster boasted loudly that his two horses could outrun anything in the kingdom. And one drunken minor chief close by said, "My wife could run faster than those." So the king made him prove it. And his life would be forfeit if the woman didn't win the race. Fortunately for this man, he was married to a woman with a little bit of magic. And she won the race, but she was also forced to run naked. And she was heavily pregnant. And when she collapsed over the line, having beaten the two horses and saved her husband's life, she gave birth to twins, who then went on to have legends of their own. But a goddess named Maka was looking down and she was not happy with this treatment of a pregnant woman. So she called a curse on the men of Ulster. And the curse was that every year for a foreseeable future, for 3 or 4 days in a particular month, the men of Ulster would be confined to bed with the pangs of childbirth.
So
I always get a great reaction from the women on the coach.
I would bet. But I was just amazed that you guys both know both of these legends. And that right there is just scratching the surface of what you guys know. It's a deep appreciation of the history and the heritage and the mythology. And it goes way back. So you do need to have kind of an understanding. First of all, how far back do those stories go?
It's impossible to tell because they were only handed down in an oral tradition. One of the very influential people in Celtic or Gaelic society was the storyteller, the bard. Before Christianity arrived in Ireland, we had no written language in Ireland. So the stories were not written down until the 6th, 7th and 8th century. And then they were written by monks, sometimes with a little bit of embellishment to make it all appear Christian, sometimes not, you know.
Right.
Yeah, the fact that they weren't Christian obviously dates it a bit. That they were 2,000 years ago. And in the stories, you see, it talks about the types of weapons they used. So there's some bits of contemporary evidence there that would put this to around 500 BC.
500 BC.
Give or take.
Now, Stephen, when we go back to 500 BC, we have all this movement of peoples. And just very briefly, give us sort of an overview. You've got Angles, Saxons, and Celts. And then you got Normans and Vikings.
Yes.
So just kind of define how all that mixes together.
Yes. Important to say, though, that the British Isles, or the British and Irish Isles, at this time that we're talking about, when Cú Chulainn was running around, were all Celtic generally.
See, that's fundamental. It was all Celtic. And then what happens?
The Celts had an empire that stretched from Croatia and northern Italy all the way through France, down into Spain and up into Britain and Ireland. But they didn't have any common king. We were a cultural empire. There was no political empire.
Because so Galicia in Spain and Brittany in France, they're also Celtic.
Celtic, exactly.
Okay.
So the Romans went to war with the Celts, which Celt comes from Keltoi, which is Greek for dirty, smelly barbarian or something to that effect.
Right.
And they started crushing us and sending us into the fringes, like up into Brittany, up into Galicia that you just said. And then when they conquered
Scotland.
Into Scotland and Wales and also Cornwall in the south of England.
Yeah.
And they never came to Ireland, the Romans, so the Celtic culture lived on there, whereas in the rest of the countries it became more a fringe culture.
So the Romans and later, what are the Angles and the Saxons then?
They were the Germanic tribes who came into Britain after the Romans
pushed the Celts, and then the Angles and the Saxons took that land that the Romans were running after Rome fell.
Yes, the Celts don't have a connection to the Romans or to the Angles and the Saxons who are Germanic.
So the Angles came over and made Angleland, England.
Yes.
Now then you got the Normans and you got the Vikings. The Vikings came first and then the Normans.
Yes, and the Normans, of course, are descended from the Vikings who came from Scandinavia down into northern France.
Okay, so really it's that movement from people up in the north that came and they were just warrior tribes and they would terrorize and settle different areas. So all that works together. And today, when we want to travel around Ireland, let's just talk about some of the sights you might see. Joe, if you're driving around Ireland, you want to see different kinds of mysterious sites, Stonehenge age sites that go back to the pre-days.
Pre-Stonehenge, yeah. We have some remarkable Neolithic monuments in Ireland. The most famous of them would be Newgrange. It's only less than an hour's drive north of Dublin.
And then we know about stone circles in England, in Ireland.
We have lots of stone circles. I know of one, just a small stone circle. We know nothing about it other than it's there outside the town of Kenmare.
Well, and when you travel around Dingle Peninsula, for example, one of our favorite places in the southwest of Ireland, it's like an open-air archaeological museum. Everywhere you look, there's these mysterious stone structures that date back to, over 1,000 years ago. And Celtic crosses, to me, are just very evocative.
The Celtic cross, that's the early Christians in Ireland, they used the mythology that was already there and the worship systems that were already there, and they incorporated them into Christianity. And the Celtic cross incorporates the sun, a circle, into the crucifix. And that's...
Is that a way to make pagan people a little more comfortable with the new religion?
To incorporate their, not necessarily worship of the sun, but their belief that the sun provides everything that's good and bad.
This is Travel with Rick Steves. We're talking about Celtic and Ancient Ireland. Our guides are Joe Darcy and Stephen McPhillamy. Our phone number is 877-333-7425. And Brent is on the phone from Columbus in Ohio. Brent, thanks for calling.
Hi, everyone. Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
Hi, Brent.
How's your experience in Ireland when it comes to, you know, mysterious bits of the past?
Well, I'm actually planning a trip to Scotland and Ireland coming up, and I've read so much about the fairy forts and fairy mounds and some of the fairy gardens, and I'm really interested in where I might be able to best experience or see some of that, and how do I respectfully bring that up as a topic, because I understand there might be some a little bit of some superstition around that, and how I bring it up might be kind of important.
Stephen, any thoughts for Brent?
Brent, it's good that you've asked the question, because there is a little bit of sensitivity around it. There's people that you would say, can you show us where the fairy fort is? And everybody will know where the fairy fort is, but not everybody will believe in it. But we do have a lot of respect for it. So it's good that you're going to be sensitive about it. People will embrace you too. And there's people in every parish, every village in Ireland who'll be happy to take you to the fairy fort and share the legends with you, but also tell you the doom that awaits dare you upset the fairy fort.
Because you took me to a place, Stephen, in Dingle, where the road was straight, and then it actually went around a fairy fort. It could have continued to go straight, but you didn't want to disturb it.
That's right, yeah. And you see that popping up everywhere, people changing road directions and not wanting to cut down hawthorn trees in the middle of a field, and certainly not wanting to damage a stone circle.
So Brent should say, when he's talking to his Irish friend, excuse me, is it okay to ask for a fairy fort?
I would just simply say, can you direct me to the nearest fairy fort?
In the legends of Ireland, Brent, there was a people who lived in Ireland maybe 4,000 years ago, and in Irish folklore they're known as the Tuatha De Danu, the people of the tribe of Danu, and they were a magical people, and they controlled the land, and then Ireland was invaded by the Milesians. Despite their magic, the Tuatha De Danu were defeated and agreed to settle Ireland between the two of them. The Milesians, they got all the land above the earth, and the Tuatha De Danu were banished beneath the earth.
Oh, there you go.
And the Milesians thought they had the best of the deal until they discovered if they didn't pay homage to the people who were below the ground, then their crops would be destroyed.
So Brent, be careful as you travel around Ireland. Thanks for your call.
Thank you.
We're celebrating the mysteries of ancient Ireland on Travel with Rick Steves with Joe Darcy. He provides custom walking tours of his home base in Dublin. And tour guide Stephen McPhillamy also operates a bed and breakfast on the harbour in Dingle. Websites to our guests are included with each week's show notes at ricksteves.com/radio. Celtic crosses to me are just very evocative. We actually find those in some Dark Age monasteries and so on.
I wouldn't call them Dark Age monasteries, because...
Europe was in the Dark Ages.
Europe
Ireland
was in the Dark
at this time
Ages.
Was
Ireland
the...
was not. Christianity was flourishing in Ireland in the 6th and 7th and 8th century.
So that was called the Age of Saints and Scholars.
Yeah, the Island of Saints and Scholars, yeah.
How was it that Ireland was the Island of Saints and Scholars?
I think it's because we hadn't been affected by the Roman Empire. Christianity was new to Ireland in the 5th century.
Mm-hmm.
And how or why St. Patrick and his fellow missionaries had got such a grip on the Irish psyche. But the Irish people became Christians in the 6th, 7th century, and they became the most Christian country in Europe. The Dark Ages in Europe is when Christianity had taken a hit after the collapse of the Roman Empire.
Mm-hmm.
And after the Roman Empire fell, Irish monks then went back over to Switzerland and to Italy and set up monasteries and began to teach people things that they had forgotten after they were, you know, crushed by the Germanic tribes.
So they brought it back.
They brought back civilization. There's a great book called How the Irish Saved Civilization. We always say a very modest title. But they came back into Europe and brought light back into the Dark Ages of Europe. Not to say that Europe was completely in darkness, but if you grow up in Ireland, you're led to believe that we re-enlightened Europe again.
This is Travel with Rick Steves. We're talking Celtic, ancient, mysterious Ireland. Our guides are Stephen McPhillamy and Joe Darcy. I'd love to finish our conversation with just one place you particularly enjoy taking people to give them an appreciation of Ireland's distant and misty past. Joe Darcy.
For me, it would have to be Newgrange. a 5,200-year-old monument just about 30 miles north of Dublin. And it was built by a Neolithic people. And these would have been around the time of the Tuatha De Danann that I was talking about. It's a monument to honour the dead. And it's built in such a way that as the sun rises on the 21st of December, the winter solstice, the sun's rays penetrate a 55-foot-long chamber and light up the inner chamber.
So wait a minute, this is a stone circle with a dome over it, like a sod-covered dome, is that right?
Yeah.
And then it's got one passage going to the middle.
Yeah, but we're talking something that's 200 feet across here and 200,000 tons of material.
And it's in darkness all year long.
All year long, yeah.
Until that one moment.
When the sun's rays penetrate along the passageway, light it up, the sun continues to rise, the sun's rays disappear again, and that's it for the year. It happens on the day before the day after to a certain extent.
Okay.
But I never, ever get tired of going into Newgrange.
Yeah.
And every time I go in, it wrecks my head. Figure, how could they possibly design this 5,000 years ago?
There's no way we can really appreciate those civilizations. Yeah. Stephen McPhillamy.
My favourite ancient site in Ireland is in the northwest. It's in Donegal and it's called Greenan Aileach. So basically means the worshipping place of the sun. It's a circular ring fort. It's up on top of a what we call a mountain, but you know maybe 1,000 feet hill. And it's got a diameter of about 50 feet. And then the wall is probably 20 feet tall. And I love this site because it's a 2,000-year-old ring fort. The ancient kings of Ulster used to be crowned here. And then they would stand and look over everything that they possessed. And I also love it because it was built at a time when there was no borders in Ireland. It was just tribes and ancient clans. We didn't even feel Irish then. We felt our clan, your loyalty was to your clan and to your locality. So I like it because I'm from up there. But it's a pretty impressive site. And I think a lot of people going up that direction would love to take the effort and drive up to the top of the hill. And there won't be any big crowds up there.
That's for sure.
It's called Greenan Aileach.
But clearly, the more you know about what you can see and the better planned you are when you go to Ireland, the more you'll get out of your visit.
Agreed.
Stephen McPhillamy, Joe Darcy, thanks so much for sharing an appreciation of the mystic past of Ireland and how we can incorporate it into our travels today.
Thanks, Rick.
Thank you, Rick.
A few years ago, when Sarah McCormick was a producer on our show, she took a family history trip to Ireland to get acquainted with the land of some of her ancestors. Right away, she found that a love of music was a big part of the friendship she made, and it got her in touch with her own Irish roots.
It's my first night in Ireland. I visit a place called the Dawson Lounge, which bills itself as Dublin's smallest pub. And it feels like it. It's not much bigger than my college dorm room. It's late in the evening, and a group of very happy people at one of the bar's two tables invites me to join them.
Come sit with us.
We're having a good time.
Come sit there.
They're a group of tourists like me, Americans and Australians, plus some local girls. And instead of talking, we just sing. The Guinness probably has something to do with this. But there's a lot of beer in the U.S., too, and I've never walked into a sing-along like this at a bar back home. In the town of Westport, in County Mayo, my Irish friend takes me to a pub to hear a man he claims is an encyclopedia of Irish songs. The man's in his 80s, and he sings without accompaniment, sitting on a stool in the back of a crowded pub. He's surrounded by delighted tourists, and a group of young local boys I would have expected would be spending their Saturday night hanging out in a nightclub, not with a man their grandfather's age. But they listen respectfully to each song he sings, and try to stump him by coming up with requests for one he doesn't know. They can't.
So now me boys take warning. Stay single while you may, for if you will, you'll be a slave until your dying day. And the lady with the lovely face and smile so warm and grand, she's probably a devil too, like my old Mary.
Irish people generally know that song. Or they pretend to do.
That's Liam O'Riordan, He's a singer from County Cork and a popular local performer in the town of Kinsale. When the pub fills with tourists, he teaches us the words to some popular Irish songs.
Here we go, come on.
A lot of our history is in our songs. So they either, you know, remember a battle or the famine or immigration.
As we stumble through the lyrics, the locals in the pub join in, or at least mouth the words while tapping their toes, like they can't help themselves.
Irish women, when they're doing their work, would sing and just listen and hear things, and just pick up the songs that way.
From a pub somewhere in Ireland, where I'm singing very badly, but enjoying every minute of it. This is Sarah McCormick for Travel with Rick Steves.
Travel with Rick Steves is produced at Rick Steves Europe in Edmonds, Washington, by Tim Tatton, Kasmara Hall, and Donna Bardsley. We get website support from Andrew Wakeling, and our theme music is by Jerry Frank. Read what Rick's been thinking about lately on Facebook and Twitter, and you can find out more about our guests each week on our website at ricksteves.com/radio. We'll look for you next week with more Travel with Rick Steves.
Do you need to contact the Massachusetts Attorney General's Office? The Attorney General's Office deals with a wide range of issues, including elder services, civil rights, fair labor, health care, insurance and financial services, housing, open meeting laws, public charities, and victim compensation. If you aren't sure who to call, an information specialist can direct you if you call the main switchboard. The main switchboard is 617-727-2200. Once again, that's 617-727-2200.
This is Bird Note. I'm Dara Miles Wilson, and I'm a birder and naturalist from Maryland. A decent pair of binoculars can considerably enhance your enjoyment of birds. Since binoculars are an important tool for birdwatching, here is a crash course on how to use them. If you're picking up your binoculars for the first time, adjust your set to ensure the distance between the two barrels lines up with your eyes. The goal is to get a uniform, circular image when looking through the lenses. If you wear glasses, roll the eye cups down for more comfortable viewing. Next, find the diopter adjustment knob located on one of the barrels close to the eyepiece. It's usually near the right eye cup. Fine-tuning the diopter helps compensate for the differences between your eyes. Finally, adjust the thumb wheel, also called a focus wheel, in the center of your binoculars. Turning the wheel one way brings closer objects into focus. Going the other way focuses on distant objects. A professional trick is to look at the object with the naked eye first, then bring the binoculars up to your eyes instead of scanning for objects through the binoculars. Now you're ready to watch the wildlife. This week is Black Birders Week. To learn how to participate, follow the hashtag BlackBirdersWeek on social media and visit birdnote.org.
WICN Public Radio is a proud partner of Audio Journal. Audio Journal provides news, information, and entertainment to visually and print-impaired residents of central Massachusetts. Audio Journal broadcasts are made possible through the use of a portion of WICN's broadcast frequency. 90.5 WICN is Worcester's only NPR affiliate and the voice of arts and culture in central Massachusetts. Visit WICN.org for more info.
Did you know ADA paratransit riders in Worcester, Auburn, Boylston, Leicester, Northborough, Oxford, Westboro, and West Boylston now have the option to schedule trips through the Worcester Regional Transit Authority's new online reservation system. Call customer service at 508-791-9782 or email paratransit@therta.com to begin scheduling your trip online.